Well, okay, then we'll get going here. After my lesson done, I kind of like to think about it. And we're doing this thing on the Bible as a contract. And I thought about how privileged a position we are in the 21st century to check our assumptions about the Bible, which means that the Bible is written a long time ago and we've made some assumptions about it. And our assumption is that the Bible is written in a literal manner, consistent literalism, newspaper literalism, we call it. We said the Bible is a devotional, not really a devotional book, although it can be. It's not a puzzle book, but it can have puzzles, and it's not to be interpreted because it's supposed to be read and obeyed, not to make something out of it. So we are dealing with a contract, and I thought, you know, it's from our perspective, we have the opportunity to see if our assumptions about that is a contract and we understand it literally actually is right. Because you don't know that until it's over with that you find out whether you're right. So we looked at whether the land promise was literal, and it is. They're back in the land, right? I mean, there's a lot of talk about it that they don't have right to the land, but the fact of the matter is they are in the land, and they are established as an independent nation among the nations of the world. There is no doubt about that. You may not like it. Not you, but the world may not like it. People may argue against it, that say it's not legitimate, whatever, but they are in the land. So I would say, so far, so good. We said when God said to Abraham, this is going to be your land, and we understood it literally, and so Abraham is for eternity. I say we're right on track, so we're okay with that. So we come to the next question, well, is the seed understood literally and, you know, eternally and all this kind of stuff? And that's really what we're doing today. So we're ticking them off, say, yeah, we assume that we're going to look at the Bible literally. And so my question is, how did it work out? Were we right in our assumption that we interpret the Bible literally? So if it was literally, then we answer, you know, we can answer whether it's literally or whether it was figurative. And obviously we get to this point, that's our privilege. We can look at the Bible and say what God said to Abraham was literal. I mean, no ifs and buts about it. It's literal. So I put my little diagram on the top. The land is, you know, that they were in the land and they were out for 70 years in Babylon, but they were back in the land. They were in the land until 70 AD with the temple, and then they were kicked out of Jerusalem, not kicked out of the land. Don't get me confused here. They always were in the land. In 132, the Romans tried to establish a Roman colony there. And by the way, I never know how that did work out. I can talk about that sometime. So then from a while, from that time on, 132, let's just say, the land was a wasteland, as a vacated land. It didn't mean the Jews weren't there, but no one else was there. No one's really claiming it. And everybody down to Mark Twain says it's a waste place. It's for jackals. That's what the Bible says it's going to be. It's useless for any good use. So it's vacated. And then until 1897, when Zionism starts, we have this rebuilding of interest in the land again. And then we have that land promise is fulfilled in 1948 when they become established as a nation. So that's the land part. Now look at the seed part. You know, the seed was at home during this time. I take out not 70 years, but even during the 70 years, when they were in Babylon, most of the people were back in the land. Only the leadership left. So we can't ever say the seed was out of the land, ever. So the seed was in the land. And then we go into the diaspora. Again, no, never can you say there weren't anybody in the land, but the center of gravity of the Jewish population was everywhere else but in the land. So I have this circling, you know, they were everywhere and moving around and never one place forever. So we get again to that 1897 date when Zionism began with Theodor Herzl. And we have World War I now, we have World War II. And by the time we get to 1948, they're in the land. The people, the seed, are in the land. So I say, so far, we can take everything literally because that's exactly how it worked out. And they said, no, it's not literal. What's the argument? Why is it not? It works out literally. All right, so that's kind of our joy here, being able to have a perspective of looking back. We can look back and see how the land promises were to be interpreted. And our assumption that to be interpreted or to be understood literally is right on the money. And that's what we want to be, right on the money. To use a gambling phrase, I guess. So now I've told you a little bit about this. We have a perspective, this unique perspective. Think about that. At your age, advanced age, we have a perspective that no one else has. And those that live beyond us are going to have even a better perspective. I doubt it's going to change. I don't think we're going to have to go back down and say, well, after all, it's allegory. We just kind of missed it. We thought it was literal, but in the 22nd century, no, it's not going to be. Yeah, it's going to be just like we see it. So in our study, we have asked, what is the Bible? The answer is it's a contract. So if it is a contract, then we ask the follow-up question, since it is a contract which predicts God's action, remember, God's contract tells what he's going to do in the future. Now, there's other things in it too, but that's the part that we would really miss if he wouldn't tell us about the future. And no one else can do this. So he tells us about the future, then we just ask now after, well, from Abraham to now, it's 4,000 years, how did it work out? We have 4,000 years of history to examine. I'm here to announce to you, it worked out like we hoped or expected. So if the Bible is seen as God obligating himself in the future, whenever he said it, whatever he said, so it's often about the future, then we have a great opportunity to see if our literal assumptions were correct. So we were thinking literally. Did it work out that way? And the answer is yes. So what God says ahead of time. Last week, look at the promises or the warnings that God gave Israel as they were on the verge of entering the land. The formula is simple, timeless, and not negotiable. That's the contract. And these are the kind of the 4 points of it, where I've got it listed here. First of all, the land is for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and their family for eternity. And we're talking about literal land. Do I have to say that again? Now, the rules to live in that land will be prescribed by the law. We call it the Ten Commandments, actually the Decalogue, the whole Jewish law given, which they accepted at Sinai. So now we have on the law a two-party contract, not a one-party contract. That's why I put the first one in green, because that's a one-party contract. From now on, it's going to be a two-party contract. So the rules to live by are given, which they accepted at Sinai. Now, living in the land necessitates their obedience, and I say plus or minus because they weren't perfectly obedient, and they weren't perfectly disobedient either. So when does God apply his judgment? Well, that's up to him. That's number four, the time of judgment, come or go. Times, and we're seeing part of it already, and we've seen some in the past. There's more to come. So the time for judgment is the prerogative of God. Okay, so just because he doesn't judge today doesn't mean he's not going to do it tomorrow. So for the Israelites, there were blessings in obedience, and there were curses, which is the scattering and being miserable, if they were disobedient. Yet God was merciful for the 14 centuries, from 1400 BC, let's say, on, as the Jews ran hot, mostly cold, in their obedience. But God didn't kick them out right away. So in 586, to kind of lose this one body part at a time here, in 586 BC, they lost the Shekinah glory, the very presence of God that led them out of Egypt, the glow of the pillar of fire by day and the cloud, fire by night, the cloud by day, glory, led them and took its residence in the tabernacle, and it leaves in 586 and never to return, so they lost something big there. And the occupation of the land for the 7 years, we talked about that. They go out into Babylon, come back. Then they lost the temple, the sacrificial system, which is the core of Judaism. And they lost access to Jerusalem from 132 on for a time. So today we want to talk about the many seed, whether that's grammar is right or not, I don't care. And we'll talk about the hated seed, the hated seed. Next week we can talk about the loved seed more. So we have the control of the land was taken and the seed scattered to the nations. So we have the temple destroyed in 70 AD. And we have the Aelia Capitolina, 132. And it's a Roman city. In fact, if you go to Israel today, this is the picture you'll look at when they have excavated down to where the Roman city was. And that's how it would have looked. In fact, they have these columns that have been excavated. You can see. So the columns are behind you here. Then the rest of it they make as a picture. So it looks like you're standing in this Agora, the place where the Romans had their trade. But the interesting point for me is the Romans came in on top of Jerusalem, destroyed Jerusalem, Jewish Jerusalem, built a Gentile city called Aelia Capitolina. That's what they named it. And then I think that the city must have disappeared. because you never hear of it anywhere. I mean, I'm going to research this because I thought about this. Whatever happened to the city? I mean, the Romans built it. Surely it's still, you know, it lasted for some reason or some while, but it died out too. So the Romans didn't even make anything of it. So the land was lost. The control of the land was lost. The people were scattered. That's where we are by the time you get to 132. So last week, there was no doubt about some, and always, the Jews have voluntarily moved to other places in search of opportunity and more space. There were a lot of Jews. They didn't all fit in this land. It seems like the Jews have been everywhere in the world. We call it the ubiquitous Jew. So in the diaspora, the scattering of the Jews, thus, far outnumbered the Jews in Palestine. This is from Britannica. The Jews outnumbered the people in Palestine even before the destruction of 70 AD. Thereafter, the chief centers of Judaism shifted from country to country, Babylon, Persia, Spain, France, Germany, Poland, Russia, and the United States now. And the Jewish communities already gradually adopted distinct languages, rituals, cultures, and submerged themselves in non-Jewish environments more completely than others. While some lived in space in peace, others became victims of violent anti-Semitism. And we think of the language that the Jews talk called Yiddish, and that's a combination between Hebrew and German. So, I mean, that's what the point they're making here. They absorbed some things of culture, but they didn't become absorbed in culture. In the whole of history, many found their way or were forced to live in other lands where anti-Semitism was the rule rather than the exception. And there were places that the Jews were tolerated for centuries, and then the areas of Eastern Germany, particularly the last ending of it, from about 1300 on, we have them in Prussia, in Russia, and what's today part of what is today Poland. That's where they really lasted for almost 800 years, something like that. And somehow they were accepted there, they were tolerated there, and that's where the word the Pale, beyond the Pale, comes from. The Pale was the Jewish settlement. So if you live beyond the Pale, that means you're outside the Jewish settlement. So we use that as an expression today. These exceptions were apparently necessary, on God's point of view, to preserve the seed to build the later nation, as per God's promise to Abraham. However, after 132 AD, all were forced out of Jerusalem, not this land, just Jerusalem for a time, yet others were tolerated in other lands, or in the land of Israel. The Bar Kokhba revolt in 132 to 135 made life more difficult for the Jews. He was a Jewish guy leading a revolt against the Romans. Now they lost access to Jerusalem. The Romans were so incensed with what the Jews did, they even kicked them out of, Jerusalem. They no longer had the temple, now they have no access to the city. Now this extra judgment, as in the Babylonian captivity, if you remember that from the Old Testament, once God had pronounced a judgment on the Jews, they ought to have accepted it rather than fight beyond God's protection. So that's what happens. In some ways, the Jews are zigging when they should be zagging. You know, when they say, well, God's going to judge us, well, now we're going to really be spiritual. Well, then God judges them for being spiritual, you know, making an attempt at the wrong time. Just a couple of pictures here show you that they just went everywhere. This is from AD to 500. They just scattered. And we're talking mostly Europe here. You look at northern Africa, into northern Germany with Colonia and so forth. So they scattered. And now on the reverse cycle, we have them coming back from land, and look where they came from. And the wider the bar, the more people were represented there. So we have a lot of them come back to Israel, and look at the top graph over here. We see that a lot of them during the time of World War II or before World War II, a lot of them left Russia, the Pale area, and they headed for America, headed South America, Canada, and some Australia. So we have kind of a division here. What they're doing is actually vacating Europe. And those that are left in Europe are actually ones that become subject to the Holocaust. So what we see in these two pictures is that the Jews have moved around. And from 46, they're moving back to Israel. This graph shows that 387,000 moved back to Israel from 46 to 51. Now, we're talking about the seed, remember? Let's keep track of what we're talking about. We're talking about the seed. So the hated seed. Now, this is the hard part for us as Christians to have to actually admit. Now, there's a website that chronicles all these persecutions, and I just picked up from 1484 because we get to 1492 when Columbus discovered America, the Jews were kicked out of Spain. So I just have a bunch of these up there. This is a screenshot of listing of anti-Semitic activities in less than 100 years in Europe, and many more are shown. I'll show you next panel, too. Bovia expulsions, Jews burned alive, stake burning, public execution, public torture, execution, expulsion, 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 mob attack, public torture, expulsion, expulsion, stake burnings, expulsion. And we've got Toledo, that's in Spain, I think. We have Astorga, I don't know where that is. We have Spain, Lithuania, that's in the Baltic or Russian states up there. Portugal, Germany, Lisbon, Berlin, Strasbourg, France, Regensburg, that would be Switzerland, I think. And then we have Krakow, Portugal, Naples, and Italy, and then we have another whole panel, and it just goes on and on and on and on. So there's probably got to be a couple hundred of these entries about the attacks on Jews. So anti-Semitism leading up to the establishment of the nation in 1948, without exception, and there may be one, which there's one in Manchuria. I don't know whether that's a Christian event or not, but without exception, with that one question on this list, all the Jews that were expelled from the land were expelled from Christian nations. That's the hard part. The Christian nations, not the Buddhist, you know, not the, no, we can't talk about Islam here, but none of those other pagan religions had anything to do with it. They apparently didn't have any problem with the Jews, but the Christians had problems with the Jews. Kind of the opposite of what it should be. So the most hated seed in the Western world came from Christians, a seldom acknowledged truth. Now, I'm saying Christians in a broad sense, and I'm sorry, though, in that broad sense, there probably would have been some believers, too, because we all know Christians who are anti-Semitic. Sorry, that's an anomaly. A seldom acknowledged truth is that the Jews have suffered more at the hands of the Christians than from the Muslims. In fact, the Muslims, the Jews would rather live under the Muslims than under the Christians in medieval days. Or the secular people, since the Christian or Jew persecution is built on replacement theology, that the church replaces the Jews in blessings only, and they are now God's good people. I'd really like that. We are the good people. The church has seen the Jews as usurping the Christians' rightful place. Martin Luther, just going to read part of it, claiming that the Jews thirsted for Christian blood and urging the slaying of the Jews. And on, used by Hitler. Now we have the church is good, and I have a real question about this. I know it's redeemed by the blood of Christ, but to say that the church, the people, and now again, we got to go broad. If you're going to go broad of the Jews, you got to go broad of the Christians, that the church is good, an unconscionable thought is that the Gentiles are better than the Jews, astonishingly self-serving. And I think about the guy in his priestly are, you know, get up growling at the Jewish girl. It reminds me of Cinderella. So Christian anti-Semitism has the appearance that the angry stepsisters against the true beauty Cinderella. And you see this in these cathedrals. The Christian church with the staff is looking glaringly at the Jewish girl with the blindfold, and she has a law usually in her hand. And obviously a put down of magnitudes. And this is repeated again in the cathedrals of Europe. Now, where did all this come from? Well, Origen the heretic, not Origen with an I, Origen with an E, the heretic, twice excommunicated for his doctrines, excommunicated, but his doctrines are accepted in a couple of centuries by Augustine. Origen, in this is his words are being paraphrased here, in his allegorical system, when the text says Israel, whenever it says Israel, you got to understand he really means the church and not the Jews, so long as the promise or comment was good. As long as it was good, then it was for the church. If the promise or comment was not good, then Israel really meant the Jews, not the church. Now, if that isn't self-serving, did I say that? I mean, so obviously, it's blatant. All right, land. So we asked the question, how did it work out? From our perspective, we have examined the question surrounding the possession of the land, and we find that they have the land. The next question now is the seed. We will examine this question for the same time period. So we maybe start from 1897, for example. We can skip all of this. I mean, we can, but it would take a long time. But I think that the proof is in the pudding. The end is where we want to look. How did it work out? Not how was it working out. We can now say, how did it work out? We have that perspective. We will examine the question for the same time that is the 19th-20th century, the time leading up to the formation of the nation of Israel, which needs land and also needs seed. Now, this is difficult to talk about. I mean, difficult in order to mentally keep it straight. So closely are these two related, the land and the seed, the land space and the seed people. It is hard to talk about them separately because we never talk about a people unless they have a land. I got thinking about this. You know who I am? I'm a man with his wife and family, lives at an address. That identifies me. Now we talk about homelessness. What do you have then? He's got no place to go. Nothing is his. He controls nothing. He's totally subject to the winds, to the hail, the snow, the economics. He could die. All right, so when you have a person, he needs to be tied to a piece of property, even if it's rental. Some of you live in a rental property, live in an apartment. But that's yours because it's yours by right because you pay the rent on it. Now, you take away that land, what do you have left? Well, you take that away from a people for a long time, you have nothing left. And it's almost like our American Indians, they almost have lost their identity because they have no place to go. They try to put them on plantations, and that didn't work out too well. So the Indians really are now being absorbed. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, but they're being absorbed into the culture, which would probably be normal. And so they no longer have the individual identity. Now, depending on what kind of person you are in this question, whether it's a good thing or not, but it's happening. So once you lose a land, you have no really recognition of being a people or a person. Now, you're a person, but you're a person without any, consequence. Okay, so we have this closely related. The land and the people are closely related because we are related in the same way. That's my point. I'm going to go home to my land, and you're going to go home to your land, and the Jews are going to go home to their land and say, well, the land doesn't matter. Yes, it does. So closely related are these two elements, the land and space, the land space and the seed people. It is hard to talk about them separately because people without land are no people. Except, we have one exception here, the Jews. They can be a people without the land, and everybody marvels at that. How can that be? You can have, and we say, every time I say the word people, I should say seed, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the seed. So a people without a land are no people at all, excepting as God provided for it. So remember when we studied, go back to land here, but remember they fit together. You can't have land without people without land. Remember we studied the recent Balfour Declaration stating Britain's intention to establish a homeland for the Jewish seed in 1917. As we studied the land section, we know that all the countries signed off on and were in agreement with an international body to favor a state solution. They all signed off on that. Don't really rehash that again. This was the period leading up to the issuing of the Balfour. Before 1917, this already was done in the land, for the land. After that, the international, maybe I should skip this. I'm going to run out of time. But then after this, we had the International Committee, the League of Nations accept this. So we have the whole idea of a land being provided for by the national community. And I got to read this. So remember that after the National Committee on the Versailles, that San Remo meeting, dividing up Europe after World War I, they took the language of the Balfour, incorporated it into international law, and became international law when these nations gathered together and then ratified it. Already then it was international law. Then again, the same language was adopted by the League of Nations, which was being formed. Then Britain, after the Prime Minister Lloyd George, who was pro-Israel, after him and an about-face, took and held a strong anti-Jewish land position from then on. They maintained this anti-Jewish stance throughout the rest of the 20 years of the mandate period, which they resigned in November 47, which became effective May 15, 1948. So as soon as the British were somewhat the midwife for the birth, they backed off and tried to kill the baby. With insurmountable odds, the Jewish seed declared the State of Israel May 15, 1948, the United States, Russia, recognized a new state immediately, as was expected, the war against the Jewish nation was to strip the Jews of their land and destroy the seed. They really don't care about the land. All this was driven by a sincere hatred against the seed, not the land. It's the seed they hated. The acts were not necessarily against the land. It was a worthless piece of land. Everybody agreed to that. It's a pile of rock. And God saw to it that it was a worthless piece of land. But it was against the seed that they act, not against the land. They had no interest in the land at all. And that is still true today. Only reason they're interested in land is because the Jews are there. That's the seed. Okay. Hating the seed was popular. By the end of World War I, the die was cast to deliver the land to the Jewish state. God saw to it. We've seen that. All marvelous things that happened. However, it took World War II to establish or make willing the people, the seed for the land. I've heard me say that three times. It took the Holocaust in Europe to make enough of the seed willing. Not all of them, but enough of them to make a return. There were stories about the treatment of the Jews, the seeds during the seed during the war, but it was not until the end of the war when the atrocities of the Nazi Germany were revealed. But before this was known, we have this as the public opinion poll of American people, public opinion toward creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. But this is America. Was taken the last week of March, 1945. Remember, the war was over in May? Okay, so it's at the end of the war. And obviously there's pressure. The stuff starting to leak out about the Holocaust, not much, but some of it was. So the results was surprising even to the pollster, who found that half of the Americans knew about the idea of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine. Half of them knew about that idea. Now, that's really quite something in our day. Unless you saw it on your iPhone, you don't know it's true, or even a rumor. And there was sentiment among those polled who had an opinion. Those who had an opinion on the issue ran 3-1 in favor of a great majority of those who thought U.S. government should use its influence to establish it. So 75% of the people who had an opinion, which is probably a few, thought that the United States should help them. So when you look at the United States, the people were really in favor of this. Now we jump over the ocean to Britain. We have this Halifax, British, international secretary, thought, and he's looking at us. He thought about the American public had no strong opinion on the issues concerning the Jews. Well, we just saw they did have an opinion, and they told us what side they were on. So, but he says they had no strong opinion on the issues concerning the Jews, aside from favoring loosening the restriction on Jews who wanted to immigrate to Palestine. Now, he says the Americans, that's why I keep this argument kind of confusing. He says that the Americans blamed the sad plight of the Jews on the British government, since there was a feeling in liberal quarters that more Jews could have been saved from Hitler if Britain had admitted more to Palestine. And that's probably true. Britain's held the door. Well, Halifax saw this feeling in part as a result of, he thought, American anti-Semitism. So he said, the average citizen, he thought, does not want them in the United States. Doesn't want the Jews in the United States. Now, Halifax saying that about us, and we just saw the opinion was 75% thought they should at least establish a nation for them. So the reason they're doing this is they don't want them in the United States. So it's kind of anti-Semitism without saying it. The average citizen does not want them in the United States. Salves his conscience, Americans supposedly, salves his conscience by advocating their admission to Palestine. Now, for me, it seemed like a stretch, but that makes Halifax feel a little better. Well, anyway, fact of matter is, in April 45, readers of the New York Times learn about the extent of the Nazi Germany war against the Jews. A delayed dispatch dated April 16, informed the readers of what the reporters call the horror, the brutality, human indecency of Dachau and Birkenhauptwald concentration camps. German neighbors who had feigned ignorance of the camp's existence were confronted with the reality when they were taken to see the remaining 20,000 Jewish prisoners, many of them barely alive. Well, it was then that the Americans learned for the first time of the torture rooms, the execution chambers, gas chambers, the medical facilities where Nazi doctors had performed fiendish experiments on living human beings. It was a scene that might have been a picture of hell. The stench, the filth, the misery here, the reporter wrote, defies description. Now, we mentioned that the British attitude was still strongly anti-Semitic, alibiing that the Americans were just as anti-Semitic as I read to you. But I think what we really see is here the diplomatic corps of the United States was anti-Semitic, and that's what he was reading. The Americans were just as anti-Semitic as the British government. I mean, I remember the diplomats are not the people. So even in March, when Roosevelt died in April, two months, a month later, there was little American diplomatic sympathy for the Seed. Historians believe that if Roosevelt would have lived, he never would have recognized the State of Israel. And his real person was exposed. It was easy to see that he played a fool on the ship, the USS Quincy, February 14, 1945, after the Yalta Conference with Stalin, and wasn't Churchill then, with Ibn Saud, the Saudi Arabian prince, complained how the Arab world works. So we have a picture of him sitting there on the deck of Quincy, and this 5-minute interview, so to speak, informed Roosevelt how the world works from an Arab point of view. And Roosevelt says, I learned more in these last 5 minutes than I've learned my whole life about the Middle East. And so I just sort of sat in my class, would have helped a little bit. But he took fully the Arab side of this thing, fully on the Arab side, made commitments to Assad that he would never recognize Israel, do anything on behalf of Israel that would hurt the Arabs. So it was here that Roosevelt made commitments to Ibn Saud that were impossible for Truman, the successor of office, to keep. Truman ends up recognizing the State of Israel with all his State Department opposing such an action. For many Jews, the situation have not improved since the U.S. troops. Some more bad stuff. In May and June 1945, 18,000 Jews died. Now, we're talking about Seed here, remember? We're not losing track of that. They're just Jews. These are the Seed, the promised Seed, are dying of starvation and disease in the Bergen-Belsen, I think it's Holland, at Dachau, the same camp the press had reported on. 60 to 100 survivors of the Holocaust were dying each day after the war was over, after the Allied, all right. But not all mistreatment of the former Nazi prisoners was due to the inability of the U.S. troops to care for the many refugees. One notorious case, that of the camps administered by George Patton, who had been, remember Patton, he believed in reincarnation. Remember, you know him? He believed he's reincarnated as one of the great Greek warriors. So George Patton Jr., mistreatment of the Jewish refugees was due entirely to Patton's anti-Semitism. Now again, this is within our government. So we may have the people have their views, then we have the leaders do their thing, and they're not always very good here about this. So Patton's Third Army controlled the southern zone where most Jewish displaced persons were to be found. The camps Patton was responsible for had barbed wires, were patrolled by armed guards. Patton wrote in his diary on September 15, remember how much later we are now, we're talking April now to September, that others believe that the displaced persons is a human being, talking about the Jews here now, which he is not, and this applies particularly to the Jews who are lower than animals. Remember this after the war, after the Holocaust, and he comes up and says this. The Jews are to be kept under armed guard, Patton explained, otherwise they would flee, spread over the country like locusts, and then to be rounded up again, and some of them shot only after they had murdered and pilfered innocent Germans. Which side is he on? I love Patton the movie, but wow. And he was really a weird person. But he was great with military stuff. So the Jewish victims struggled to find an identity other than displaced persons, which is now the world as how the world referred to them. I remember my grandmother, my dad's side, my dad's mom always talked about the DPs. The DPs, they're doing this, the DPs are doing that. So that was the way they talked about people. I'm not sure that I understood then that they were the Jews, but there were other displaced persons as well. Okay, the Nazis had sought to dehumanize them, living with numbers tattooed on their arms. You've seen that. But they called themselves the survivors and adopted their own symbol of a stump and a branch, which I'm going to leave go because I couldn't find a picture of it. But the idea is that the seed lives on. They somehow have a sense. They know that we've been killed. We've survived Nazi Germany, but our seed still lives on. Now, there's a lot of bodies laying around, but as a group, as a promise, there's enough left that God can make something out of it yet. So the seed lives on. We're still literal, remember? We're still literal. Now, one would think that after the tragedy of the European Holocaust that the world would pour out its sympathies for the downtrodden seed, but the survival of the seed was only assured by the Abrahamic covenant, a covenant that only God could make good, literally. For anyone who doubts the truth, they need to restudy the plight of the Jews in the 20th century. That alone tells a story. Of course, this story is built on 4,000 years of Jewish history, which we have on our board. We're just looking how did it work out on the end. And we're not at the end yet, but from our standpoint, how did it work out? So it is a disgrace of exponential magnitude that from the time of Christ, the Christians have tried to eliminate the seed. I hate to use the word Christian in that same sentence, but I'm sorry, I have to. Now, here's a little good story here. And the American history regarding the Jews is not all bleak. America has been the best ally of Israel, not always the same consistency, but to foreign policy has always supported the Jewish state, even under adverse political leadership. It has 50% of the Jewish population inside its borders, interestingly. All are welcome. They're full citizens. There's no restrictions that I know of officially that any Jew can't hold any office or do anything he wants to do, just like you and I. There's no restriction on the Jews in America. By the way, this is only in America where that can happen or has happened. So to the credit of George Washington, our first president, he officially welcomed them to Rhode Island, make the Jews a welcome part of our new nation. The original Washington's letter to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, which we visited a couple years ago, is small in size, but its impact on American life is immense. In 340 well-chosen words, the letter assures those who have fled religious tyranny that life in the new nation would be different, that religious toleration would give way to religious liberty, intolerance, must be, and that the government would not interfere with individuals in matters of conscience and belief. Quoting the Old Testament, Washington writes, "Everyone shall sit in safely under his own vine and a fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid." Now, obviously, that's a millennial passage, but he used it now. It continues, "Or happily, the government of the United States give to bigotry no sanctions, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens and giving it on all occasions their effectual support." Now, when George Washington wrote this particular letter in August of 1790, the new president must have been unaware of the effect it would have on the fledgling nation. He could not have known the extent of the influence today. And I think we look at seminal things. This is one of those things that God authored in the mind of George Washington. Don't think that he's a believer at all, but he favored the Jews in the beginning of the nation, and that blessing has continued in our nation till this day. And by the way, that blessing is what the left is fighting with everything they have today. Everything they have today. They want to stop this blessing, which makes no sense to me at all. So, Ulysses S. Grant was anti-Semitic. I just mentioned that. And Abraham Lincoln reversed his view. So, we have some of these somewhat anomalies in our country. So, as we said, the land and the seed are separate but inseparable. The reclamation of the land officially was on May 15, 1948, as was the recognition of the seed as having legitimacy to occupy the land. And that's what they don't like. Both have traced a different trajectory, but both have ended at the same point in history. You can't separate these two things because it's the seed that made the land happen, so to speak. The Abrahamic covenant, how did the land and seed work out? One word, perfectly. I rest my case. Now, we say perfectly, well, it's not over yet. That's true. That's why I'm saying it's not completely in all respects. But if we look at it from our camera pictures, whatever, snapshot at this point, there's no reason under God's heaven that we would say what he meant to Abraham was to be said, understood anywhere else than a literal promise. And when you take it differently, we have anti-Semitism, We have the carnage of the Jewish people. The seed, the very seed that God has promised, will not die off or being attacked by another supposedly seed in the Christian church. So it's incredible. And that's the end of my lesson.